You have a whole section in your book that covers Jimi Hendrix, and obviously you get into the way in which he leaves an indelible impact on rock and roll music, and you know he's a black musician, but in the way that he records his music, and in many ways there's actually a post-racial element to some of what he does, I think you could probably argue. In fact, what you cover and highlight is something that's iconic from Jimi Hendrix's life, which is the performance at the Woodstock Music and Art Fair in 1969. Mm-hmm. And since it was the 50th anniversary last year, I actually wrote a little bit of a piece because I was curious. In fact, for the first time last year, I had an opportunity to go to Bethel, New York, and see this amazing sight, and how it's just a natural amphitheater that everyone could gather in, and it's really the perfect place for gathering hundreds of thousands of people if there ever was such a place. But the thing that I ended up digging into and latching on was that the people who were in attendance at Woodstock are truly the ones responsible for imbuing the Star Spangled Banner performance with something that was hugely political. That's my conviction. That's what I feel. And I think it's an interesting example of how a song, an interpretation of a song that is performed by an artist, because of the moment in which it's performed, it takes on a political meaning.
Mm. I agree with you on that, Kevin. And I would go one step farther and say that it was not only the people who saw Jimmy perform the Star Spangled Banner, but it was also Michael Wadley who created the documentary Woodstock so that the entire nation could see that incredibly powerful and emotional instrumental on the big screen. Not surprisingly, a lot of musicians, I've read a lot of interviews of musicians who say that the first time they heard the recording of Jimmy playing the Star Spangled Banner, they had tears spring from their eyes. John McLaughlin, the great electric guitarist who founded the Mahavishnu Orchestra after he left Miles Davis, is somebody I interviewed for Music is Power. He told me he was just overcome. His friends were overcome when they heard it. The representation of the sound of bullets and bombs and controlled guitar feedback, not just noise, but controlled guitar feedback that emulated the sound of human screams. So there you go. You know, Jimi Hendrix being one of the few people in the history of recorded music to make a political statement without lyrics. And if you ask me who else has done that, there are certainly lesser known examples, but not many. There's a black jazz musician named David Sanctius who played Dixie. I wish I were in Dixie, away, away. But he plays it in a minor key with synthesizers and other keyboards, and it's very ominous. So that is a political statement. Tomita, Isao Tomita, the Japanese synthesist, who took Gustav Holst, the planets, and did an amazing version of Mars, the Bringer of War, from Holst on synthesizers. And it, too, is just chilling and powerful. But really, other than that, I can't think of examples of pure instrumentals that make a comment that is political in nature. And the irony, of course, is Jimmy was already playing the Star Spangled Banner in club dates. I wrote a book called Becoming Jimi Hendrix, as I mentioned earlier. And when we researched this, we found out that he had fooled around with the Star Spangled Banner at club dates, and he probably played it 40 or 50 times live, but it was Woodstock, which of course was a huge event, and then Wadley's film exposing it to the entire nation and world that made Jimmy playing the Star Spangled Banner. I don't think it's hyperbole, Kevin. A lot of people say it's one of the iconic musical events of the 60s.
Oh, absolutely. And yet at the same time, what it did for a black musician in 1969 who had rocketed to fame, who had this very legendary kind of following already. And he was immediately under this pressure to be an anti-war voice and to be someone, you know, he actually, you could argue, came under the same kind of pressure of like a Bob Dylan to be someone who could speak to all of this. But in fact, he just wanted to play music. It's the way I interpret his career.
Yeah, I think that's a very smart connection between Jimmy's reticence and Dylan shifting from the overtly political to more epic songs, as it were. Now, in the case of Dylan, he had so much pressure put upon him by society, and he also evolved as an artist, as artists should be allowed to do. Then you throw in a motorcycle accident that nearly took his life in 66, and while he's convalescing, he's starting to think about other ways to create music. Even though, you know, the folk people, the folk audience resented it, we derived a lot of great music from Dylan because of that. Now, Jimmy, I almost say don't forget, but I don't expect that everybody knows that Jimmy was in the 101st Airborne Division at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. He had been caught joyriding in a car for a second time. He hadn't stolen it, but the judge said, okay, this is your second offense, Mr. Hendricks. You can either go to jail or you can join the Army. They actually offered that to people in the early 60s. So he joined the 101st Airborne Paratroopers, did terribly. But in the process of being in the military, Jimmy came to understand what we know today and what was talked about in Vietnam, which is the disproportionate number of men and now women of color who joined the military as a vocation. And Jimmy used to write in symbols. He was never an on-the-nose kind of guy. I love one of my favorite songs of his is Are You Experienced, not only for its sonic quality, but he was the only guy during that period, Kevin, where there was a lot of drugs, a wider variety of street drugs than any time in U.S. history, and a lot of psychedelic music, of course. And in Are You Experienced, he had the nerve to say, not necessarily stoned, but beautiful. He was the only artist who had the balls to do a song that said, it's okay to reach a higher state of consciousness through drugs, but it shouldn't necessarily only be drugs that raises your consciousness, and that elevated consciousness is absolutely necessary to improve our world. So Are You Experienced doesn't mean have you taken LSD. It means do you connect to human suffering, and are you willing to do something about it? And for that reason, it's just a phenomenal piece.
Yeah, and within the genre of psychedelic music and what evolves from it into being progressive rock music to some extent, you cover some of the music of Pink Floyd, and in particular in our conversation, I wanted to focus on The Wall as a concept and what was developed with Roger Waters being involved, and also the fact that in concert, the way in which this wall was set up brick by brick and the way it is incorporated within the performance. I've had an opportunity, which I think everyone who likes this music should see. It's not the same as the live experience, but if you can capture it, if you can see it captured in film form, the concert documentary that was put together of this wall performance, and it's a more recent performance with Roger Waters, but you know, to see the way that it is done and a representation of how it is all laid out, then you really can tell that this is one of the most, I think, important anti-fascist kind of rock albums that is out there. It seems to me. And while it's a very intensely personal album for Roger to have created, with some of the stories in there being so personal and tied to his grandfather and father, as far as all of us and what it means to us collectively, I think it speaks incredibly to the moment in which we find ourselves.
Absolutely right, my boy. Very well said. I have to say that there is a channel called Access TV, and Dan Rather of CBS does interviews. So here you have Dan Rather, you know, pushing 90, interviewing rock stars. But damn it, he's one of the best interviewers there is. And his interview with Roger Waters, if anybody can catch that in reruns or on demand, is exceptional. You learn that Roger Waters' grandfather and father both died in World War I and World War II, respectively. So he was robbed of that those relationships, and it, of course, shaped who he became in terms of a creative artist. And, you know, Pink Floyd, before I get to the wall, let me set up something else, Kevin. Pink Floyd is probably the group in the history of rock and roll that spoke more to alienation and madness than any other group, more often and in many ways in a more emotionally deeper way. And the irony about that is Sid Barrett, the founder of Pink Floyd, went mad. Now, there's a question as to whether it was an organic brain problem that led him to what we assume was schizophrenia, although he was never diagnosed, and then it was exacerbated by taking lots of LSD, or whether the LSD created some kind of psychic break. So I talk about that mystery in Music is Power. But the incredible twist of fate is when they lost their leader. Now it's Waters and Gilmore and the rest of the boys going, what is it that we want to do songs about? The songs that were written by Sid Barrett were charming little offbeat ditties, psychedelic little ditties. And amazingly, after losing Barrett, they cared so much about alienation that, and of course, the loss of Barrett, that they had songs like Shine On You Crazy Diamond, and we all know that Dark Side of the Moon was one of the longest charting albums in history, because not only was it a beautiful suite of music, but it talked about alienation, it talked about a disconnection, feeling that you're controlled from beginning to end, and these are themes that are extremely important, especially to young people when they're listening to music. So now on to the wall. It is a brilliant idea. It seems so simple that it can't be profound, but it is, because when you recreate a wall, it represents so much more than what we're now dealing with Trump's wall on the southern border. It's about barriers of sexual preference and color, socioeconomic differences, the difference between being a citizen and being the government. It works in so many ways. And I can tell you, Kevin, that I did see between 2010 and 2013, he did a number of tours of the wall, Roger and his band. But the one that I saw in Los Angeles, as they're building the wall, they're projecting, this is so brilliant, they're projecting the images of dead soldiers, not just in the Vietnam War, but in Iraq and Afghanistan. And you're seeing this continuity of lives that are lost in war, and you're starting to think about what generates wars and who benefits and who does not. And it was one of the most thrilling live concerts I've ever seen.
Well, and I believe now, and this goes to Roger's own activism, he'll project images of the wall that is put up by Israel to keep the Palestinians out, that long barrier that is there. And that's part of his activism. And I also, I note before we move on that the music is, it can fit into just about any sort of show that you would want to do to raise the consciousness of humanity, because the Us and Them tour that Roger recently completed a few years back was about the refugee crisis, and it included a couple new individual songs that he had recorded for his solo album, but he did entirely, for the most part, it was like off of the Dark Side album, a few cuts from The Wall, and then perform parts of Animals as well, and creating that whole thing. And Roger's also responsible for, or not solely responsible, but the Pink Floyd's responsible for this pig, this floating pig that I know Roger's been using in his live shows to make incredible political statements for at least the last two decades or so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, also you have a World War II fighter plane that goes down, quote unquote, and explodes over the heads of the audience in the Walter. So again, he's connecting to this incredible loss of his grandfather and father, and the pig representing greed, and the Wall, as we discussed. And the Wall also, I guess we mentioned it, but I don't mind emphasizing it. Right now, there is more mass refugeeism in the world than at any time in history. And there's obviously a tendency for authoritarian governments to blame immigrants for the inherent problems of those countries. And it's incredibly tragic. And, you know, obviously the United States is not the only country that is doing this and has done this. That goes back to Woody Guthrie, by the way. You know, do re mi, if you ain't got the do re mi, boys, you ain't got the do re mi, then you go. You better go back to beautiful Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Georgia, Tennessee. I mean, the Dust Bowl in 33 and 100,000 people a year trying to get into California and being turned away if they didn't have $50 on them. So you come to start thinking about refugeeism as kind of a tool of the state to lay blame rather than accepting responsibility for the problems inherent in the countries.